Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Little Georgie Learns to Drink right after this. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton said one time he was the guest of honor at a banquet which was given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press, and Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now you know it and I know it. And there isn't one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. And I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are, he said, the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program. It's this new world order. The men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this new world order, this global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 Bible prophecy in this new world order, call and order our free general law CD package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Just call 417-273-4967 and order. Just say, hey, send that to me, would you? Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or just call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Hey, we're talking about this thing of drinking, binge drinking. Little Georgie learns to drink. I learned how to drink by revelation. My dad took me and set me down at the table at age 12, mixed me a highball and said, here, let's have a drink together. So, well, some people, I guess, would say, boy, that guy Gordon, he just fell right into utopia there. He went to heaven and died there. No, but it served me well. I haven't become an alcoholic. I haven't become a binge drinker. I didn't kill myself with the rest of the kids. Several of the students that I went to high school with, they're dead now. Some of them turned into alcoholics. I don't know that anybody necessarily turned into a binge drinker and killed himself by alcoholic poisoning, but that occurs every once in a while, and I mentioned that in the last program. I said, you know, about every two or three months, there'll be an article in the Reader's Digest about some kid in college goes out binge drinking, and he dies from it. He died from it because his parents never educated him in how to drink, like my dad did. So I wanted to point out to you that it probably would be of advantage, instead of practicing abolition, if since we're going to drink anyway, we might as well learn how. I mean, if you're going to practice sex, and nearly everybody does, well, then shouldn't you learn the proper use of sex so that you don't get AIDS, herpes, and VD? Now, the Bible is a book that teaches a lot about sex, teaches a lot about alcohol and drinking, teaches you the good side and the bad side. Now, the religious people are opposed to drinking in any way, shape, form, or manner. I mean, they're abolitionists. There isn't a temperate preacher out there. There's none out there. They don't teach temperance. They teach abolition. Now, that's in drinking. Now, when it comes to sex, they don't teach abolition. They teach moderation. You know, sex before marriage. Oh, well, you should practice sex, you know, safely. And you know, we know you're going to do it, but, you know, be careful. And in the areas where they should be teaching abolition, they're teaching moderation. And in the areas where they should be teaching moderation, they're teaching abolition. Now, to give you another illustration, there's a practice prescribed by God Almighty himself called polygamy. Polygamy. Comes in two forms. It comes in polygamy, polygamy, in which a man has two, three, or five wives all at the same time. Oh, the religious people come unhinged at that. The idea that man would have two wives. My God, they just go ballistic on you. Then there's a second form of polygamy, and it's spelled polygamy, polygamy, And that's where you have two, three, or five, or nine wives, one at a time. One at a time. I'm a polygamist, and I've had two wives, and then I had them one at a time. I had a wife and then divorced, and we got another wife. I might divorce her, and then I might have a third wife and divorce her, and then I might have a fourth wife that dies, and then I might have a fifth wife. That's polygamy, spelled G-E-M-Y. Now, polygamy, spelled G-A-M-Y, that is having two or three wives all at the same time, is scripturally prescribed. And there are 24 cases in the Bible, 24 examples, 24 guys that are mentioned with specificity that had or that practiced polygamy. Now, I'm not here to advocate polygamy. I don't practice polygamy. I've got one wife, and I don't intend to have two. Polygamy was prohibited to priests. They had to be the husband of one wife. But polygamy is the equivalent of a vertically integrated corporation, and the reason for it was for business. It didn't have a lot to do with sex, although sex comes into play. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the main thrust or purpose behind polygamy. Business is the main thrust behind it. And God, the religious people are just coming. In fact, we got laws here in the United States that prohibit that. And there's a group of people called the Mormons, and they were practicing polygamy. And then the Congress enacted an anti-polygamy statute in 1876, aimed right at those people. And there's about 30,000 polygamists here in the United States today. They typically are what they call Jack Mormons, but it still goes on. In fact, polygamy is practiced in other cultures around the world. But it's really looked upon as being wicked and evil. And the preacher, just ask any Christian preacher what he thinks of polygamy, and he'll tell you. He tell you it sucks. But it's an institution created by the same guy that he claims to represent, God. You know, he claims to represent God, and this is the guy that instituted polygamy. Some very famous polygamists, Jacob had four wives. Jacob. David, King David, he had six wives. Solomon had, 700 wives or 300. 700 wives and 300 concubines or 300 concubines and 700 wives. Now, a concubine is a wife. I don't know if you knew this or not, but a concubine is a wife whose children do not inherit. So if you thought that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 mistresses over there, he didn't. They were all wives. And as a result of that, you know, we're infected with this thing of religion. I pointed that out to you, that the religious people are opposed to drinking. And then one famous religious guy said, alcohol has never touched my lips. And I said in the last program, I said, well, that guy's no candidate to teach drinking. He doesn't know how to drink. He's never drank in his life. He doesn't know temperance. He doesn't know moderation. He doesn't know how much alcohol affects your body. Doesn't know how it affects it. Doesn't. He's never experienced it. I mean, how would you like to learn flying airplanes from a guy that has never flown in one? See how crazy this is? All right, so I mentioned in the last program that the logical thing to do to prevent binge drinking and people killing themselves in colleges and high schools from this binge drinking is to teach them intelligent drinking in moderation. And in order to do that, you've got to have somebody there that knows how to drink. And so I suggested that you hire an alcoholic, bring him in. So let me show you how to mix these drinks and so on. It would be a step forward rather than having this drinking taught by abolitionists. Not that an alcoholic is the guy that's going to teach you moderation. I mean, obviously the guy doesn't know moderation, but you know, my dad did. And there are people out here that can drink and drink in moderation, and they're not killing people and driving drunk, and they're using alcohol responsibly, just like there are people that use sex responsibly, use automobiles responsibly, eat responsibly. And I mentioned to you last time, I said, you know, you don't tell people not to eat for fear that they'll become gluttons. It is certainly true that gluttony is a problem, and that people that eat too much are called gluttons. But we don't teach abstinence from eating because people become gluttons, and I would submit to you that we ought not to teach abstinence from alcohol because some people will become alcoholics, but that everybody should be educated. Now, that's what choice is all about. In the final analysis, we want to have freedom of choice, and the foundation of freedom is choice. You see, freedom of choice is the cornerstone of education, and instruction is the cornerstone of choice. Knowledge is the cornerstone of wisdom, and wisdom is the cornerstone of life. Choice is the foundation of freedom. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, God told you to choose. He gave you some instruction, and then he says, now choose. Make up your mind. What do you want to do here? Now, as adults, as parents, we're not making very good choices. You see, we want to have children, but then we don't want to educate them, as evidenced by the fact that you send your children to public school. It's pretty obvious that you do not want to educate your child. So you send him off to public school and pay somebody to do that for you. Well, I think that's a bad choice, but you know, if you're going to do that, don't you think that you should ask the educator over there to teach your child how to responsibly smoke Roytan cigars? Teach him what the pitfalls and the downfalls of smoking are. What's good about it, what's bad about it. Because your children are going to experiment with cigarettes. I don't care. They're going to experiment with drugs. They're going to experiment with alcohol. So my dad didn't want me experimenting with my pimply-faced punk friends concerning drinking and driving and sex and so on. So he took it upon himself to teach and train me personally. He said, come over here, boy, let me explain this to you. I'm going to explain it to you. And he did. And as a result of that, I was alerted to the pitfalls before it happened to me. He alerted me to the pitfalls of driving techniques. He alerted me to the pitfalls of sex. He alerted me to the pitfalls and the benefits of the whorehouse and getting married and not getting married and so on. Now, you can sit there and argue, well, I would never do that. Well, okay. But then you're a candidate then for your kid one of these days, killing himself by binge drinking. And then you're going to sit there and say, and lament. And God, I'll sympathize with you because I can't imagine anything worse than for a parent to lose a child. I mean, that is just a tragedy that is beyond grief and description when your child dies. I haven't had that happen to me, and I hope it never does. But I would like to share with you, children die from lack of education. And the education ought to be coming from parents. Now, if you educate your child, then you've done your job. You know, my dad educated me. Now, if I go out and kill myself with a bottle of booze, you know, well, I was told. But you see, you need to be told, and young people today are not being told. They're being educated by their peers at spring break down in Guadalajara, Mexico, or someplace on the beach where they're practicing illicit sex, binge drinking, drugs, and they're not being given the other side of the story. Now, my dad gave me both sides of the story, explained it to me, told me how it worked, why it worked that way, and he was an experienced drinker, and he was the right guy to teach me drinking. He was an experienced smoker, and he was the right guy to teach me about smoking. He was also married and had children, and he was the right guy to teach me about sex. He knew and understood how that worked. He knew I was going to go down to the whorehouse at some point in time in my life. Everybody does. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody should. It just that's the way life is. Experimentation now is what we've all been taught. We are educated from the time we're little children. We need to experiment. It's kind of like cancer research. You know, we're out here just constantly researching and experimenting with drugs and all kinds of cures for cancer, aren't we? We've been doing that and spending billions of dollars. Now, how many cancer cures do you know of? So experimentation is not the best way to learn. And you can sit there and experiment until hell freezes over and never find a cure to cancer. Now, it happens that there's 14 cures to cancer, 14. And the reason that I know all 14, well, it could be 18 or 20, but I know of 14, and I know of all of these 14, because it was revealed to me. I never experimented with a single one of these cancer cures. Hell, I don't know anything about curing cancer. But I know of 14 cures, and I know how to deal with cancer. If I come down with cancer, I'm not going to my local medical doctor. Now, when people get cancer, they go to the doctor. I can't for the life of me understand why you would want to go to a medical doctor when you come down with cancer. Think about it. You go to the doctor, ask him this question. Do you know what causes cancer? And he's going to tell you, no, I don't. Do you know how to cure this cancer? And he's going to say, no, I don't. Now, why would you want to go to somebody to treat, cure, or solve your cancer problem when he tells you plainly, I don't know what causes it and I don't know how to cure it, but for $100,000, I'll experiment on you until you run out of money or die, which is what he's going to do. And there's an upside to it. 37% of the time, you're going to live for 5 years. If you live for 5 years, he's going to tell you you're cured. I don't know what happens if you live for 5 years and you're cured and you die the next day. I guess that's called a relapse. I don't know. Now, if I'm a mechanic and you brought your car into me and you said, my car is not running very well, would you listen to this for me? And so you start the engine and I listen to it. And then you ask me, can you hear that? And I say, yes, I can hear that. And then you say, do you know what's wrong with my car? And I say, no. And then you ask me, can you fix that? And I say, no. Would you then say, well, would you work on my car for $25 an hour until I run out of money or until my car is a total wreck? No, you wouldn't leave your car to somebody that would tell you, I don't know what's wrong with it and I don't know how to fix it, but you'd go to a medical doctor who's going to say, I don't know how to cure cancer and I don't know what causes it. And we spend, oh, hell, that's $500 billion a year on cancer in this country, here in the United States. I know it's insane, but that's the way it is. All right, now let's try this. You send your kid to church, you send your kid to Sunday school, the preacher doesn't drink, he tells you plainly, alcohol has never touched my lips. He's an abolitionist. You live in a world that's surrounded by booze. You send your kid off to high school and college. You know if you've got a brain in your head, unless you are absolutely brain dead, you know your kid is going to experiment in college at some point in time with some alcohol, some cigarettes, some drugs. Don't you think that you should reveal to him first, you, parent? You can't leave it to the college professor. They don't teach drinking in college. You can't leave it to the high school teacher. They don't teach drinking in high school. You can't rely upon the preacher to teach your child drinking, or Sunday school teachers don't teach drinking. They teach abolition. Abolition is not education. That's my point. Now, God is a great educator, a great teacher, and he spends a lot of time teaching you about alcohol and booze. Now, while the preacher is telling you about all the wickedness and evil that is attached to alcohol, and there's a bunch of it, and the Bible is full of all kinds of neat statements in here about booze and how bad it is for you and how it's going to harm you. I don't deny that. But it's also filled with a lot of positive statements about booze, about how it's good for your health, about how to do it responsibly, and how it's going to make you feel real good and you're going to like it. It's kind of like sex, you know. Sex makes you feel real good and you're going to like it. But if you use it irresponsibly, you're going to come down with venereal disease and gonorrhea, clap, herpes, VD, sexually transmitted diseases, venereal warts, crabs, and AIDS are not pleasurable. They're not good for you. Now, we don't teach our children abstinence from sex because we're afraid of sexually transmitted diseases. What we try to do is to teach them about sex and responsible sex so that they don't get AIDS, herpes, and VD. Now, there's a little disagreement between the Bible and the conventional educational world as to how that education should be disseminated. I don't deny that. But in any event, both sides are agreed that people need to know something about sex, except for alcohol. My God, you shouldn't know anything about booze. Alcohol has never touched my lips. Don't you think, Mr. Hovind, that you should have tried a little alcohol, or for no other reason that you should have experimented to find out good and bad, right and wrong? In any event, his answer is no to that, and so, okay, well, I'm glad that your children grew up and didn't die. Now, fortunately for all of us, most kids can go through the life experience without killing themselves with binge drinking. But there are a few that are going to die that way. Most of us can go through the automobile experience without killing ourselves in an automobile. But there's always a small minority of young people that kill themselves in cars. And their parents lament their deaths every single time. And then they ask themselves, gee, was there something that I could have done? Is there something that I should have done that I did not do that would have given my child a better chance? Okay, so let's take a look at a couple, three of these. Jesus drank. Did you know that? Jesus was a drinker. Alcohol crossed his lips. Did you know that? All you preachers out there teaching people that they shouldn't drink, did you know that God himself drank? He was a drinker. In fact, he drank enough that the religious people called him a wine bibber. He was called a wine bibber. Did you know that? And he turned water into wine one time. I've got to tell you a little story over here. It was in John. Stick around here. This is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here's John. And in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, there's a wedding feast going on, and Jesus, you know, sweet Jesus here, he was asked to do something about a shortage of wine at the wedding feast. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what have I to do with you? My hour is not yet come. And his mother said to the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And there were set there six water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing two or three firkins apiece. All right, now, this is about 108 to 162 gallons. Now, this firkin, you know, has different sizes and measures. It's kind of like a, you know, like a measurement in various locations. You've got some people that measure it one way and some people measure it another way. And so there's variations depending upon where you are in the world as to how much this is. But measured in gallons, the way we measure here in the United States, at the low end it would be 108 gallons, and it could have been as much as 162 gallons. Now, a gallon is about 4 liters for you people that are on metrics. 4 liters is a gallon. Now, that's a bunch of wine there. You know, when we have Passover here, or we have a Feast of Tabernacles or something, we might have 10, 20, 30 people here. And I can assure you that a gallon of wine for 10, 20, or 30 people will usually do the trick. It's a glass or two for everybody, you know, wine glass. And now they're at this wedding feast, and Jesus is going to turn some water into wine, and it's not a little bit. It's 100 to 150 gallons of wine. And so Jesus said to them, well, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said unto them, draw it now and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. And when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to the bridegroom, he says, now every man at the beginning does set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But you have kept the good wine until now. All right, now, this was the beginning of miracles that Jesus and Cana did in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory and his disciples believed on. Okay, now let's think about this for a minute. If Jesus was teaching people abstinence, why would he turn this water into wine? How come he didn't turn it into Pepsi-Cola or Mountain Dew or milk? Now notice in the story over here, the governor of the feast, you know, the guy who's in charge of putting on the wedding, goes to the bridegroom, he says, now listen, you know, people normally put out the good wine first. Now, I don't know. See, you teetotalers out there, people whose lips have never had alcohol touch them, you might not know this, so let's learn a lesson. Wine, when it's aged, tastes better. It doesn't have any more or less alcoholic content. It doesn't make you any drunker or keep you any soberer or more sober, but it tastes better. So wine is aged, and typically whiskey is aged. Sometimes whiskey is aged for 7 years. Jack Daniels, for instance, and it's charcoal filtered, and it goes through various processes. And so there are people that drink wine, and they're wine tasters and connoisseurs of wine. I'm not one of them. I drink wine as wine as wine as wine, you know. Hell, you could give me a bottle of Ripple, and I couldn't tell the difference. But, you know, I'm not one of those. But there are people out there that like wine, and they're connoisseurs, they call them, of wine. And I can, honest to God, I can tell you the difference between Burgundy and Cabernet Sauvignon. I can do that, but when wine is aged, it tastes different. Whether it's better or not, that's a matter of judgment, but it tastes different. And so here's the governor of the feast. My God, you have kept the good wine, the Cabernet Sauvignon. You've been serving Muscadoodle, you know, to people first, and now you're saving the Cabernet Sauvignon, the Pinot Noir, to last. Why are you doing that? And that's because, you know, after these people are drunk, well, they couldn't tell the difference between wine and beer anyway. Well, you know, I'm just exaggerating there a little bit, but the moral to the story is, here's Jesus. Not only did he make wine, he made good wine. It was a miracle. And he made this wine out of water. And then the servants could see that. The governor of the feast, he didn't have any idea where it came from. Now, Jesus made wine. He was a wine maker when he could have been making Pepsi-Cola or Kool-Aid or something else, couldn't he? I mean, look, if a guy can turn water into wine, do you think maybe he might be able to turn water into Kool-Aid? Maybe turn water into Pepsi-Cola? I just throw it out there for your consideration, you know. Why wine? Why did he turn it into this alcoholic beverage if Jesus is against wine? If the Bible is teaching abstinence. Now remember, the Bible isn't teaching abstinence. It's religion that's teaching abstinence. The Bible is teaching wine. And that's just your first step in our journey here. This is God himself, and he actually made wine, and it was good wine at that. Well, isn't that just special, Mr. Hovind, whose lips has never touched wine? Huh? Hey, this is the Halfway Point. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on a compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we're citing here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about little Georgie learns to drink. Now, when I learned to drink by revelation rather than by experimentation. And I think that it was well worth and it has served me well. And so I'm bringing the subject to your attention that perhaps, you know, just perhaps, you might consider educating your children to drinking rather than letting your children's friends educate your children to drinking. It occurs to me that a 40-year-old adult is probably better equipped, wiser, has greater knowledge and experience at educating children in drinking than would be another 15-year-old kid or a 18, 19, 20-year-old college freshman. Mull it over, think about it. Now, there's another little part to this story over here that deals with drinking, and it's in 1 Timothy 5, verse 23. The Apostle Paul recommended wine as a medicine. So I'm going to find 1 Timothy 5 here. Just be patient with me, having never gone to seminary. It takes me a little longer to find places in the Bible. Here it is. It's 1 Timothy 5, and verse 23. There's a guy the other day, you know, I suggested that he get our book on the Mosaic Law, and he said, well, I've got a degree from seminary. And I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that, but you could overcome that. I mean, just because you've been handicapped with a degree from seminary doesn't mean that you can't learn. It just means that you've been taught a lot of bull feces that is of no value to you at all. It's a lot of lies and half-truths, but you can overcome that. So if you're a preacher out there, you could overcome this. Paul, when he was talking to Timothy, he said, drink no longer water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your often infirmities. So evidently, Timothy had some often infirmities. He was sick a lot. And here's Paul the Apostle said, this wine is good for medicine. Now listen, there's a little something to be said for that. There are chemicals in this wine that prevent heart disease. Did you know that? Now, for instance, the Italians and the French people don't have much heart disease. They do drink a lot of wine. They also eat a lot of fat. Now, here in the United States, we eat a lot of fat, but we do not drink a lot of wine, and we do have a lot of heart disease. Now, the Bible teaches you not to eat fat and to drink a little wine for your stomach's sake. Notice a little wine, not a lot. Well, how much is a little and how much is a lot? Well, we talked about that last time. Different people's metabolism works differently, and you'll have to experiment a little bit to find out how much you can drink. Now, I used to work for a guy named Frank Rocha. Frank Rocha drank one 12-ounce glass of wine for lunch and dinner. That was 24 ounces a day. He drank it at dinner with his dinner. He didn't drink water. He didn't drink coffee. He didn't drink Pepsi-Cola. He didn't. You know, I imagine once in a while he probably drank a Pepsi-Cola, but the guy drank wine regularly. In fact, he bought 2 tons of wine, 2 tons of grapes. That's 4,000 pounds of grapes. And then he crushed that into juice, and then he put it in oak casks, and he let it turn to wine. He made his own wine. And I don't know how much that made, but I think it was about 150 gallons. See how much that is, 24 ounces a day. Now, I had to have a little left over for the other guys. Now, when I lived there, I didn't care much for wine, and I don't think I ever drank very much wine. I drank a little bit to be sociable, but I didn't drink very much. I never did care too much for it. Didn't like the taste of it. Pepsi-Cola was much better. But 24 ounces times 365 is 8,760 ounces divided by 128 is 68 gallons of wine. So Frank Rocha drank 68 gallons of wine a year with his lunch and dinner. He did not drink it now with breakfast. He didn't drink wine between breakfast and lunch. He didn't drink wine between lunch and dinner. He drank one glass of wine at lunch. He drank one glass of wine at dinner. And I don't ever remember seeing him drink other than at those two times, but he drank every day, every single day. Now, here's another little trick. If you're drinking alcoholic beverages and you've got food in your stomach, you can drink more before you feel the effects of the alcohol. If you drink on an empty stomach, you will feel the effects of the alcohol more readily, and it will be more severe. So here again, you've got this woman, the lawyer that we talked about last time, drank 4 ounces of alcohol, 4 highballs at a Christmas party, and passed out drunk on her way home driving her car. She probably was drinking on an empty stomach, drank 4 ounces. She was a small woman to start with, and 4 ounces was more than she could handle. And everybody needs to drink a little bit to find out, well, how much can you handle? Now, for George Gordon at 220 pounds, I can handle 4 ounces quite handily. I could probably handle 6 ounces. But I've come to the conclusion that 4 ounces of alcohol over a period of 4 hours is about all the booze that George Gordon needs to drink. Now, that's my conclusion based upon my personal experience. Now, let's take a little look at that. When we're talking about education, there are certain aspects of education, and these all come from the Bible. Now, listen to this. The purpose for education is so that you can understand proverbs, wisdom, instruction, understanding, justice, judgment, equity, discretion, revelation, experience, reproof, counsel, and the fear of God. There are 13 elements to education, and the purpose of which is to give you an insight so that you'll develop wisdom from instruction, so that you'll have understanding, so that you can apply justice and judgment and equity and discretion and so on. Now, the average kid that's on spring break in Daytona Beach, Florida, does not have wisdom or understanding or discretion. Nobody's ever educated him. He's out here experimenting with alcohol, drugs, and sex. He wants to learn. He needs a parent. He needs a teacher. He needs a college professor to educate him, and they're not doing that. They're all abolitionists. They're all telling him, don't do that. That isn't going to work. If you tell him, don't do that, he's going to go do that. You can just bet on him. Now, if he has some instruction to go along with it, now with that instruction, he can develop wisdom, understanding, and discretion, which will now guide him, well, how much should I be drinking? When should I be drinking? Where should I be drinking? Who should I be drinking with? You know, all of these are factors that come into the equation. Now, there's another part to this thing here. In Luke 10, verse 34, there's a story about a guy who falls among thieves. He gets beaten up and he's injured. And this guy goes and he binds up his wounds, he pours in oil and wine, set him on his beast, and he brought him to the inn and took care of him. Wine has alcohol in it. Alcohol is a disinfectant, and olive oil and wine are medicinal. They're herbs. So instead of putting methylate and mercurochrome and Listerine, have you ever thought about using alcohol? Natural, herbal alcohol, a food designed by God. Just, you know, thought I'd throw that out. Now, if you want stronger alcohol, see, wine doesn't have very much alcohol in it. So let's learn a little lesson here. When you look on a bottle of booze, it'll tell you what its alcoholic content is. It'll say it's 26% by volume. A bottle of whiskey will say it's 70%. A bottle of vodka may say it's 100 proof. All right? Beer is 3.2%. So when you drink a 12-ounce beer, that's equal to 1 ounce of 70-proof alcohol, 70-proof whiskey. So by the time you've drank a six-pack, you have just drank six highballs. You've got six drinks under your belt, Bob. Now, I've already told you that's a little bit more than I can handle. Now, I'm not a regular drinker. See, I'm not like Frank Rocha. I don't drink a glass of wine, 12-ounce glass of wine, twice a day. And I'm not drinking four highballs every day. No, that's not my habit. My conclusion is that's too much. Now, there's some other health reasons for that. When you drink alcohol, it destroys all the vitamin A in your body. So when you're drinking alcohol like Frank Rocha, every single day the guy's drinking alcohol. All right? Now, he has to take in vitamin A every single day, because if he doesn't, he'll have a vitamin A deficiency. Alcohol destroys your vitamin A. All right? So there's a little part to the story. So right away somebody's going, well, see, that's why you shouldn't drink. No, it doesn't. That is not why you shouldn't drink. It may be that you ought not to drink a glass of wine twice a day, every day. Has it ever occurred to us that, well, maybe we should drink a little wine three or four times a week, but we ought not to drink it every day? Has it occurred to us that maybe drinking 16 highballs every single night after work is not a good thing for you? I'm fully familiar with the cirrhosis of the liver. I understand that. And temperance is not abstinence, but it's not drinking 16 highballs a day either. Remember? Temperance now is drinking what you can handle, what you need to drink. This is kind of a personal thing that you need to find out. And you need to do it in such a way that you have some instruction so that you can use discretion. And so the Bible talks about going out with rounders and getting drunk and laying in wait and robbing people. And let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The Bible has a lot to say about the negative aspects of drinking, but it has a lot to say about the positive aspects of drinking also, and drinking responsibly. That's the bottom line, responsibly. Now, in Proverbs chapter 1 and 2, there's a little bit to be said here. So let's flip over here to Proverbs, and then let's apply this to drinking. How's that for a plan? Proverbs chapter 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. What's the purpose of the Proverbs of Solomon? Verse 2 tells you, to know wisdom and instruction, and to perceive the words of understanding. I want to have wisdom, instruction, and understanding concerning drinking. I want to have wisdom, instruction, and understanding in sex. I want to have wisdom, instruction, and understanding in driving automobiles. Why? So that I don't kill myself. So that I don't injure myself. So that I don't make myself sick. I want to get all the benefits, and I want to avoid all the penalties and problems. Verse 3, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. Notice, to the young man. See, an old fart like me, by this time you've either got it or you ain't got it. If you're 70 years old and you're still a drunk, well, then obviously it didn't work for you. I'm 70 years old and I'm not out here binge drinking. I ain't out here at Flo's Whorehouse. And I learned about whores. I learned about booze. I'm not trying to drive my car at 80 miles an hour around a 35-mile-an-hour turn. I quit flying my airplanes under bridges and power lines. Yeah. But when I was young, you know, before I had instruction, now a wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsel. To understand a proverb, and the interpretation of a proverb, and the words of the wise and their dark sayings. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Now, my son, hear the instruction of your father, and forsake not the law of your mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace unto your head, and chains about your neck. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lie wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them up alive as the grave, and whole as those that go down into the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in thy lot among us, and let us have one purse. Let us practice communism. Let us practice from each according to his ability, and to each according to his need. And God gives you some instruction. He says, my son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. And surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. And they lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives. So are the ways of every one that is greedy of gain, which taketh away the life of the owners thereof. Now wisdom cries without. She utters her voice in the streets. Wisdom cries in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she utters her words, saying, how long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? And the scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you, and I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called, and you refused. I have stretched out my hand, and no man regardeth. But you have said it not all of my counsel, and you would have none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity, and I will mock when your fear cometh. Here in the world today, especially here in the United States, we have a great depression descending upon us. And people are scared. And they're praying. They're crying out to Jesus. I tell my students, you can save your time, effort, and energy, and save your breath. He already told you he's going to laugh at you when your calamity comes. The time to have prepared for this economic calamity was before it occurred. You needed proverbs, wisdom, instruction, understanding, justice, judgment, equity, discretion, revelation, experience, reproof, counsel, and the fear of God. In short, boys and girls, you needed to be educated to the perils of economic depression. Did anybody educate you? Did you go to college? Did you go to Depression 101? Did your parents educate you in depression, recession, monetary? Huh? Any economics there? Now it goes on to say, when your fear comes as desolation and your destruction comes as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish comes upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the eternal. They would have none of my counsel. They despised all of my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. Or as my old granny used to say, well, you made your bed, sweetheart. Now go sleep in. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil. That's what education's all about. Hell, we need the education before the fact, before it occurs, before it happens to us. In chapter 2, there's a little bit more. He says, my son, if you will receive my words and hide my commandments with you, so that you incline your ear unto wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry after knowledge and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek understanding as silver and you search for understanding as for hid treasures, then shall you understand the fear of the Eternal, and you will find the knowledge of God. Because the Eternal giveth wisdom, out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He lays up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keeps the paths of judgment and preserves the way of his saints. Then shall you understand righteousness and judgment and equity, yea, and every good path. Now, the Ten Commandment model is that model that teaches education, teaches and educates, and it gives you these elements of education: proverbs, wisdom, instruction, understanding, justice, judgment. That's what you're after. Now, people that have that don't binge drink. People that have that aren't down at the whorehouse. Young men who are void of understanding, those are the guys. You know, the young men on the aircraft carrier, when it docks in San Diego or Alameda, what's the first thing they want to do? They want to go down to the bars and start looking for a hooker. That's because they don't have wisdom, they don't have understanding, and they don't have discretion yet. Now, do they have to learn through the school of hard knocks, or could you, a parent, educate them? Could you warn them about the pitfalls? Every time I read in the Reader's Digest of a child that binge drinks and kills himself, I say to myself, there's a parent that did not educate his child, and his child is dead because he was ignorant. Why do your children have to be ignorant? Is it because you, the parent, is ignorant? Because alcohol has never touched your lips? Hey, I'm out of time here again, kids. We've got to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the law hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and